Hi, this is Chris Arledge for WeRSC.com, and we're doing a special weekly podcast because of recent events and the Todd McNair litigation. I'm joined by Lizelle Brandt, who is a longtime follower of this case. In fact, she's probably followed it more closely than just about anybody, including multiple updates on the WeRSC site, multiple interviews with the jury foreman, and even live blogging the trial as it was going on. Lizelle is a practicing lawyer, a litigator. She went to USC for undergrad and for law school, and she's been a reporter for WeRSC for a number of years, going all the way back to the Pete Carroll era. So she has, I suspect, a lot of interesting stuff to tell us today. Lizelle, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Trying to stay a little bit dry, actually, in the weather. How are you, Chris?
I'm doing well, and we have some interesting stuff to talk about today. And just when it seemed like the Todd McNair story had run its course, so I think everybody who's listening to us probably already understands what came down the other day, but just in case there are a few, why don't you tell us, one, what happened, and then, two, whether you're surprised by it?
Okay, sure. Number one is that, obviously, as everybody knows, Todd McNair lost in the jury trial this past summer against the NCAA on the claim for defamation. Now, his attorneys appealed the ruling, and this went on for a couple of months where the attorneys exchanged briefs. As of January 16th, Judge Schaller issued his final ruling granting this motion. Now, the motion was actually based on two separate grounds, two main grounds. The first ground being that the evidence was insufficient to warrant the verdict, and the second ground being that the juror number two, the presiding juror, should have been disqualified for implied bias. And Judge Schaller ruled that in both cases, the motion should be granted. My initial impressions on this was that I was a little bit surprised as to it being granted, as to the issue of evidence sufficient to support the verdict. However, based on what I was seeing at the hearing on Friday, the oral arguments and the questioning of Judge Schaller, I was less surprised as far as it being granted, as far as the implied bias of the juror. So generally a little bit surprised it was granted on both grounds, but not surprised as to the decision in regards to the juror. What about you, Chris?
I was stunned, and I was stunned probably in large part because I haven't been sitting in the courtroom and listening to the hearings, and I wasn't there at trial. I just know as a trial lawyer that most judges, once the jury has reached a conclusion, assuming there's not a legal error, you know, a bad jury instruction or something like that, that mm-hmm. judges tend to wash their hands of these things and walk the other way and say, yeah, you know what, the jury decided it. That's what juries do. Leave me alone. I've got other things to do. And so I'm always surprised when a judge grants a new trial on the basis of insufficient evidence to support the verdict. And while I think we probably all suspected that Judge Schaller had some sympathy, shall we say, for Todd McNair based on the statements he's been making for the last few years, I didn't think he'd pull the trigger this way, and so I was surprised and pleasantly surprised by it.
Did you think that he would not grant it on either ground? Did you think it would be a full denial?
That's always where the safe money is, right? After the conclusion of a jury trial, that's always where the safe money is. In part because there is a bias in the court system in favor of letting juries decide these things, and second because judges tend to have their own personal interests, and that is getting things off of their plates. If he has to retry this case, that is additional workload on him, and you mm-hmm. say, well, that shouldn't matter. You're a judge, and that's your job, and that's all fine, except I know a lot of judges. I know a lot of judges are not interested
right.
in putting more things on their plate. So, yeah, I was surprised by it and pleased. So let's take a step back and talk about what do you see as particularly significant about what Judge Schaller did?
The first thing I would note is back to the whole implied bias of the juror argument is that for him to have reached that decision is that to basically overturn his own ruling earlier, because the parties had brought it up to him shortly after jury selection, when I believe the NCAA brought up that the level of Latham and Watkins' involvement in the appeals process, and they questioned the juror again, and Judge Schaller decided to still keep him on the jury, denying McNair's lawyer's request. I know a lot of people are pretty shocked that he remained on the jury, so that was one of my initial thoughts. I think it was pretty, I wouldn't say easy, but I think to remove him from the jury because of that, that's something that I would say I noticed. But I actually want to say, Chris, since you're a litigator, a trial lawyer as well, I love that I can geek out with you on this. So as far as the ruling on the insufficiency of evidence, what were you seeing in terms of the so many different ways that Judge Schaller actually, he just kind of slammed the NCAA. What do you think?
Yeah, Judge Schaller delivered a beatdown of the NCAA in this order. I don't see any other way to describe this. So let's explain what it is exactly he was saying. Mm-hmm. In civil trials, not every civil trial, but most, you have a special verdict form where the jury has to answer very specific questions. And usually the way they're structured is that if the jurors give a no answer to a question, then usually you can that's the end of either the case or the end of that cause of action. Then you have to jump down to another. And so here there were a series of questions, and the one that the jurors got hung up with on the defamation claim was whether or not what the jury said about Todd McNair was untrue. In a defamation case, you obviously have to show that a statement was made, that it was made about you, that people would recognize it was made about you, and that the statement was false. You have to prove some other things also, but if you can't prove that it was a false statement, then you lose. And the juror said, mm-hmm. No false statement. What was remarkable is that Schaller looks at this and says, no reasonable juror could conclude that. And that's what that's what his decision says, and what he's saying is, you can't be a reasonable person and look at the evidence in this case and conclude anything other than that the NCAA made a false statement about Todd McNair. That is a huge statement. It's mm-hmm. because it's one thing for judges to say what they usually say, which is, you know, the evidence, both sides presented their evidence, the jury heard it, the jury went one way, maybe I would have gone another way, maybe another jury would have gone another way, but they, you know, they had the right to make the decision, they made it, so we're all going to move on. That's not what he says. He says, you cannot look at this evidence and conclude any other way. The NCAA made a false statement about Todd McNair, and I think that's a pretty remarkable thing to say, and it's something that's going to have repercussions in this litigation going forward, I suspect. What do you think about Schaller's conclusion? I mean, you're an SC fan, so you obviously agree like I do. But is there anything about his conclusion that jumped out at you? Because I saw some things that I thought were pretty interesting in there.
I agreed with it. I was actually a little bit when the verdict actually was being read out, I was expecting that if there was going to be a no, and you in explaining the verdict form, you went through the three questions, and I was surprised that they stopped at that question as to whether or not the statements were false. I was more concerned about the next question, which was question four, did the something which was with respect to the statements of fact for which you answered yes, did Todd McNair prove by clear and convincing evidence that the NCAA knew any of the statements were false or had serious doubts as to the truth of any of those statements? That was question four, which requires a higher burden, clear and convincing, versus just proving, just answering the questions, hey, were these statements true or false? And I agree with his ultimate decision on that, because he also did, as would be expected, a good job of justifying it, which was just, you know, how the NCAA basically paraphrased the interviews, and they relied on the call with Lloyd Lake as the linchpin to basically tie up their decision, and that rested a whole lot, as we saw, on stating the year wrong, who called, what was stated. There was just a lot of, as you said, sloppiness and so many problems from hearsay and the fact that he wasn't called in. You know, was he reliable? Could they rely on that? That resulted in, I see ultimately, yeah, this is a correct decision by Judge Schaller. So, yeah, that's my thoughts on that. I agree with it. Well, even whether or not I'm a USC fan, I agree with his finding on that. I would have, I'd say, again, found more of an issue with question four later on than question three.
Yeah, no, and he was, so the key issue in his order had to do with the NCAA investigator's interview with Lloyd Lake. And you're right. He really ripped into the NCAA on that, called it botched. He called it sloppy. He said they were unprepared and essentially concluded that the interview was so bad that you really couldn't rely on it for anything. And I think actually this is where there's something interesting about what the NCAA was up to, because if you go through the portion of the interview that the Judge Schaller cites as the key portion, what you see is at the very beginning, and maybe we'll post this on the message board for people to see. But what Judge Schaller notes that the NCAA investigators, they start by getting the fundamental fact wrong. What they do is they talk to Lloyd Lake about this call that McNair made to Lake. Well, that's not true. McNair didn't make the call to Lake. Lake made the call to McNair, but they tell him at the very beginning of this section, three different times the NCAA investigators tell Lake that McNair called him at 1:34 in the morning. It's not true. Now, you go from there to Lake's discussion about this phone call. And I'm going to read a few lines from this because I think it's important to get the flavor of what was going on. So the NCAA investigators introduced this call, and they're talking to Lake. By the way, he is not testifying under oath. USC does not have anybody present, so they can't ask any questions. And so they introduce the call, and then Lake jumps in. A question isn't pending, but Lake jumps in. And this is what he says. I think that was like him trying to resolve it, you know, and like Reggie's wrong, he should make it right, and basically don't implement the school. The NCAA investigator then jumps in and says, because this is 2006 we're talking about. Lake says, yeah, that's when I went to jail. That's when everything started falling apart. I mean, it fell apart. Now, so far they haven't gotten anything from Lake except basically an unintelligible conclusion about what he thinks McNair wanted to talk about. But that's it. And so the NCAA does exactly what they should do at this point. They say, what can you tell us that you specifically recall about that conversation with him? In other words, I appreciate that you've given us this conclusion that is semi-literate, frankly, but we need more. We need to know what it is exactly that was said on the phone call. The phone call is critical. And so Lake says, just telling him about Reggie and all, he knew about the money he took, he knew that he had an agreement, and then he gets cut off. The NCAA investigator says, Todd McNair indicated to you in the telephone conversation that he was aware that Reggie took money. And Lake said, I mean, he knew. And the other investigator jumps in and says, from you? Lake says, yeah, because he knew Reggie took money from me, and there's no doubt he knew about that. Now, again, Lake is offering conclusions that so far are unfounded by any facts, right? He doesn't explain why McNair knew. He doesn't explain what it is that McNair knew. Lake doesn't say why he knew that McNair knew. He just starts to assert it. And so, again, the NCAA investigators know at this point that they don't have what they need. And so they jump in and say, why do you say that? And the other investigator says, yeah, we need to know why you believe that he knew that. Again, the investigators know at this point, we do not have from Lake what we need. So far, he's just given us some conclusions. He hasn't given us a single fact we can use. And here's Lake's answer. Because he was around a lot. And, you know, it's like he watched me get them guys, his friends' hotel rooms. Reggie told me he knew about certain things he was doing, but he's cool. You know what I mean? It's like basically through Reggie. And that's sort of the end of this little discussion. Now, the NCAA investigators walk away from that, and what do they have? they have a convicted felon who's testifying not under penalty of perjury, who's not subject to cross-examination, who they have repeatedly prompted to give them specific information about what McNair knew and how McNair knew it. And what does Lake give them? He gives them nothing, right? In that entire discussion, he gives them nothing usable. And these investigators knew it because every lawyer in the history of lawyering knows it. You look at that transcript, you say, I don't have anything.
This is not a good transcript for me to impeach, to do anything with, right?
It's a disaster. But based on that questioning, the NCAA made specific statements about McNair. And it's what really sent Schaller off because they say specifically, I'll pull this up, they make some conclusions from that here it is right here. What they say from this conclusion is agency partner A, this is in the NCAA report, so we're talking about, and uh-huh. agency partner A is Lake, said that he phoned the assistant football coach to ask him to intercede with student athlete one and get him to adhere to the agency agreement that he made with agency partners A and B. Agency partner A said he also told the assistant football coach that he did not intend to lose the money he had given student athlete one, and his parents then preferred not to go public with the matter and implicate the institution. By the way, Lake said none of that. I just read you the questions and answers. He said none of that. And so so that's why Schaller really took this significant step in battering the NCAA about the head and shoulders, because Schaller's looking at the transcripts, which are already going to be suspect because you're talking about a felon not testifying under oath and not subject to cross. But he looks at it and he says, even apart from all those defects, you cannot reach the conclusion you reached in your report based on that transcript. You can't do it. And if you say that
right.
you can, you're lying.
And yeah, and the thing is, they said, again, they mentioned that was the linchpin of their conclusions. And at the trial, Bruce Barlett actually hammered on this a lot, and this actually plays into the possible motivations of the NCAA. Was the reasoning, why would they rely on such a poorly, you know, an interview that was so lacking in clarity, in finality, in any sort of details that, again, any lawyer worth their salt wouldn't be using, but for the fact that they needed McNair in order to get USC, there's the question as to, well, why were they so desperately relying on it, that they would rely on something like this? And the fact is that when you look at what they had or didn't have at USC, it almost feels like they needed this in order to make the findings. They needed to get McNair, and that's what Boylett jumped on. So this plays very much into what the whole argument was during the trial. They needed these statements to be they needed these statements to make sense, even if it meant paraphrasing it as to the year, as to who said it, as to who made the call. So it made it look like, yeah, he knew there was illegal activity that was going on, and by that extension, USC did, since he was a coach over there. So it just plays a lot into that reasoning. And I know we're going to talk later on as far as USC and its options, but I feel like you really do get the sense in looking at this even closer. You hear it at trial, but you also see it in the transcript. Judge Schaller sees it as well. This is not something that they should have been relying on. Further, it didn't just go through the Committee of Infractions. It went through the Appeals Committee as well. So this went through a couple of different layers, and it basically just got rubber stamped. So you have them paraphrasing on one end to justify the conclusions, and then on a secondary level, the appeals committee is just rubber stamping it without even looking at the full transcript, as actually we found out during the trial. So lots of questions on this.
So let's talk – let's put USC aside for just a second, and let's talk about Todd McNair. Where does the McNair litigation go from here?
Where it goes from here, I mean, as expected, the NCAA is going to appeal this case. The CLO has already made the announcement that they're going to, so it looks like this is going to continue, and they're going to appeal the ruling.
They're DOA on appeal, aren't they? I mean, this is it's an abuse of discretion standard, which means that the appellate court doesn't look at this with a fresh set of eyes. What essentially the appellate court asks themselves is, Did the judge abuse his discretion? Was he completely unreasonable in how he saw this evidence? That is, I understand the NCAA is going to appeal, and I understand that they have smart lawyers, and maybe they'll come up with some creative arguments. But abuse of discretion standard almost always means, not always, but almost always means you're dead meat. It's hard to imagine the NCAA actually winning this appeal. And if they don't win the appeal, then it's going to get remanded to Schaller again for trial. And if you're the NCAA, what does that mean?
I think personally, tactically, I think they have to appeal it, just from everything from a PR perspective to an implications perspective around the country, how much this potentially could reverberate in terms of how awful and sloppy your processes are, how much potential exposure they have later on. But I also think that from a strategic standpoint, this is something that they could use to try and force a settlement. That's what I think. I think they're appealing, and I actually think, well, I know we'll talk about it later, that this case, I don't think this going on for another, I mean, this was 7 years between it when it was filed in 2011 and the last trial. So if that's how much time it's going to be between now and then, I think that this is probably going to be used as leverage to settle. I think they will lose on the appeal based on the abuse of discretion standard. I don't see them winning it based on, especially on how strongly justified. And I think that's part of why you see such a strongly worded opinion by Judge Schaller. It's because he knows that the chances are high the NCAA are going to appeal, and so you need to have the evidence that supports it, and that's why you have all these points to the transcript. And I think he's done an adequate job knowing that this probably would be challenged. So, yes, it goes back to the trial court, but I think before it gets to that, before the jury gets impaneled, I think they're going to settle. What about you?
Yeah, I think the case settles also, because at this point, I think both parties have a compelling reason to settle the case. If you're the NCAA, you don't want to go back before Judge Schaller, who already has made clear to you that he doesn't think the jury can say anything other than that that you were making false statements about Todd McNair. We already know that he found the evidence of actual malice, if not compelling, certainly pretty strong, because he referenced that in his decision a couple of years ago in the anti-SLAPP. And so if you're the NCAA, you're walking back into what can only be described as a relatively hostile courtroom with a judge who clearly has it out for you. Now, I think for good reason. I don't think he's being unfair to them. I think they were outrageous in their behavior. But so if you're the NCAA, I think you probably want to put this to bed if you can. And if you're Todd McNair, you can now put it to bed in a way that you probably couldn't have before. I mean, McNair's problem before was that even if the NCAA is going to offer him a substantial amount of money with a confidentiality agreement as part of the resolution, which is fairly standard in these sorts of things, that McNair still doesn't have a career. His career had been destroyed. His reputation had been destroyed. But look at it now. McNair is now coaching again. And on top of that, he has Judge Schaller really lighting into the NCAA and telling everybody that anybody who looks at this evidence must conclude that the NCAA was making false statements about Todd McNair. That's pretty good if you're Todd. I mean, Todd can now afford to settle the case, and I think the NCAA has all kinds of reasons why they want to settle the case. So I'm with you. I'd be surprised if it gets tried a second time.
I think that, I mean, at some level, obviously, because this was very personal. This was a defamation case for him. So a lot of it was, these statements were false. And I know that I think a lot of the USC fans would want him to continue against the NCAA and not settle. And the question is, again, does he get vindicated? And I think I agree that with this ruling, at some level, he could point to that. Plus, because he's got a job, arguably even an upgrade, actually, from his last USC job. Now he's in the NFL coaching running backs. It's a little less of the I've got nothing else to lose, so let me fight this till the very end. He's not in that position anymore. And maybe you just want to put it back past you. And if there is a fair offer, which if the NCAA is smart, hopefully they'll make that, then I do see this case going away. I mean, as much as I love Tweet by playing the whole trial, it was a lot of fun. I don't think it's going to happen again, because I think that hopefully the parties, they both, I mean, Schaller on the one hand found that there were, the facts didn't support it. But you also have a jury of 12, jury foreman aside, implied bias aside, that did find that defamation did not happen. And again, you still have, if you're arguing against McNair, that number four question, by clear and convincing evidence, did the NCAA know that those statements were false? A lot of people saying that that might be a hard one to overcome. So in going through a trial, seeing 12, this jury say that, you know, not defamation, do you want to gamble that again? I think they do so.
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think my conclusion is the same as yours. If they do it again, I think we'll see a different trial strategy from Roylette. I don't want to be too much of a trial nerd and bore everybody with that, but I think we'd probably see a different trial. But I just don't think it's going to happen. I think at this point, both parties have a compelling reason to make this go away, and I suspect they'll figure it out, because that's what usually happens in civil litigation. Okay. And when both parties have a reason to settle, they'll probably make that happen.
Where does this leave USC? Well, I mean, that's the multi-million-dollar question that a lot of fans are watching. I know a lot of USC fans are very happy that McNair got this victory, that he's got the job, are very happy for him. But I also know that there are people that genuinely just feel that USC really just got jabbed by the NCAA on this from the beginning, from the investigation to the Committee of Infractions report to the appeals process. This whole process, you look at it from beginning to end, was flawed. And I see arguments both ways in terms of, okay, what are USC's options at this point? People want to know, do they have a lawsuit? First of all, I'm thinking, you know, the breach of contract, the NCAA manual, its bylaws. Did they follow the laws? There's an argument for that, I think. Even the presiding juror pointed to the fact that the laws in terms of who should be involved in deliberations, it was one of their bylaws, that it specifically was violated by the interference or the involvement of Rodney Uphoff, Roscoe Howard, Shep Cooper, those three stooges, as Roylette called him. But so you've got possibly breach of contract, but the question is maybe even negligence as well. Has the statute of limitations run? And my view of this is what I don't know exactly is, because if you're looking at USC as a plaintiff, then when did they know, or when did they have reason to know of these specific violations of the NCAA? I know that a lot of documents were unsealed in February, March of 2015. So if you're going by California 4-year statute of limitations, that puts that as coming up really, really close. I believe it was February 6th when the decision was made, but the documents were unsealed in March. And again, if you want to be a little bit more on the, I would say, hopeful side, there is also an argument that in terms of tolling the statute of limitations or when it would begin, that there was testimony actually in the trial in 2018 that from, I believe it was Patty Ohlendorf, the Infractions Appeals Committee member, where you could argue that everything from her talking about what evidence was or was not evaluated, including actually, you're talking about that linchpin call with Lloyd Lake. It came out that they didn't really, I don't know if they didn't have access or didn't care to, but they didn't review the that actual call, the entire transcript of that call. And when Bruce Roylette asked her about it, or the Roylette's firm did, and she said no, I was pretty shocked. So when you look at it from the perspective of at least the NCAA Appeals Committee's violation or their upholding of the standards of appeal, the review process, I think you might have an additional argument of breach of contract from that perspective, that if it's true that we just learned on deposition how, I guess, flawed that process was and possible violation of the bylaws, then maybe that statute of limitations starts in 2018. So that's, again, looking at it from the glasses half full perspective. You want to talk about it? I'm guessing from the other end.
You know me well enough already to know that I'm a glass half empty kind of guy. Yeah, I, I would make 2 points. One is, if USC were motivated to try to deal with this in the court system, I think they would have a tough uphill climb at this point. I think, breach contract is a 4-year statute of limitations. I think tolling argument is tough here because, one, because the court's going to be suspicious that USC didn't at least have reason to suspect that the NCAA had breached the agreement with them, and I think there are specific ways that that USC knew that they probably did. I just think it's a tough sell. I also think it's probably a tough sell on damages. One of the things the NCAA did in their report is they dropped the footnote saying that the penalties assessed against USC didn't have anything to do with McNair. You'd ask yourself, well, if it wasn't McNair, what was it about? And the answer is, well, they didn't really specify that either. They had two sentences of generalities about how USC should have done a better job, but they never did say who knew or who should have known what was going on. Had USC actually chosen to engage counsel and sue the NCAA at the time, I think there's a high likelihood that they would have prevailed, or frankly wouldn't have had to prevail. We know now from Miami and Ohio State and Penn State and others that when the NCAA is confronted with their, shall we say, shabby investigations or other things, that they tend to back down. Yeah, and so I think there's a high likelihood that USC could have gotten a much better deal had they taken a firm position with the NCAA. Now, USC chose not to, obviously. They chose to try to play nice and called the NCAA fair-minded folks, which they were not. They said that we would win the right way going forward, implying that we had been winning the wrong way in the past. And they generally made a hash of the situation. And without being in the room with Nikias and Hayden and others, we can only speculate as to why that was. What we can say is the strategy they chose was a complete and utter disaster, both legally, because they got no relief from the NCAA, and in terms of the public relations aspect of it, because by essentially cowering in front of the NCAA and conceding, or implicitly conceding the NCAA was right, it seems to me they've done great damage to the institution. That being said, I don't even know that I feel comfortable anymore bashing Nikias and Hayden for that bad judgment, because, frankly, you're talking about a couple of people who probably belong in the Hall of Fame of bad judgment at this point for reasons that we know that go well beyond this lawsuit. So it's almost like piling on. So I don't think there's anything that USC will do. I don't really think there's anything they can do. I think they made a gigantic mistake at the time in not dealing with this more directly. But it is what it is. And at this point in time, the only people who care are Todd McNair, Todd McNair's lawyers, and USC football fans.
I think that's very well said. I agree in terms of the fact that they really, if they were going to act, they should have done it earlier. I think that there is, you know, as a lawyer argument, I think you can make the argument to try to for breach of contract based on those two reasons of, you know, what was known in 2015. Also with the appeals committee in 2018, I think there's a little bit of an open door, but the question is, are they going to do anything about it? I don't think they're going to. One of the things that did surprise me at the trial is that I did not see, I mean, and I wasn't there, granted, every single day, I didn't see any USC administrators there to my knowledge. They didn't testify, and I know that's another issue that the juror also brought up, presiding juror Anthony Bruno, in terms of, you know, wanting to see some witnesses that would have helped him in his trial, McNair in his trial. But, you know, why didn't somebody from USC come and testify? You almost feel like, not that they wanted to wash their hands of it, but that they just didn't want to get involved. So based on that, on the trial, I don't think that they're going to do anything about this, whether or not they do have a possible claim.
Yep. Well, we're on the same page there. Well, listen, thank you very much. This was fun for me at least. And,
always.
And it's nice that, the justice system is at least, still functioning in a way that, what I think is a pretty horrible situation, at least we'll get some redress for Todd McNair now, I hope. And that's a good thing.
I hope so. At the very least, it's good to see him over there at Tampa Bay doing what he loves to do. Some good news for him, actually, for a change. So,
agreed. All right. Well, thank you very much. We'll talk soon.
Yes.
Bye.
Bye.